From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson. Happy Thanksgiving. It's here and now. And we are exactly 2 weeks from Election Day in the United Kingdom, where Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his Conservative Party are hoping to win enough seats in Parliament to get their Brexit deal passed and take the UK out of the European Union by the new deadline of January 31st. Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party are trying to stop Johnson, but their position on Brexit is unclear. Joining us now from London is BBC political correspondent Rob Watson. And Rob, I know you don't celebrate Thanksgiving in the UK, but happy Thanksgiving to you anyway.
Well, happy Thanksgiving to you, Jeremy. And of course, I lived in the United States for 11 years, and Thanksgiving was my absolute favourite festival. It still is. I mean, if I could, I'd celebrate it here, although I suppose it wouldn't quite make sense. So very much happy Thanksgiving to you, Jeremy, and to everybody listening. I know what a wonderful day it is.
And I'm sure you'll be able to find a turkey if you really want to celebrate Thanksgiving today in the UK. Let's talk about this election, though, because we've been following it over the last few weeks, the campaign, and it seems like the polls are showing that the Conservative Party of Boris Johnson has kind of a sizable lead.
Yes, and I guess what would be most striking, really, Jeremy, is how the polls haven't actually changed. Because what happened in 2017, I mean, I know that seems like the last century or something, was that Theresa May, who was then Conservative leader and Prime Minister, she had this huge lead over Jeremy Corbyn in the polls. And of course, over the duration of the campaign, that lead disappeared. Mr. Corbyn, the Labour Party, made up some ground. And this time, that simply isn't happening. And so unless anything changes, particularly radically, between now and December the 12th, it looks like Mr. Johnson will not only be returned as Prime Minister, but with a majority.
Well, let's listen to some of what the candidates have been talking about. This is Prime Minister Johnson in a recent debate.
There's only one reason why we're having this election. That is that we have a deadlocked Parliament that will not deliver Brexit. If you vote for us, we have a deal that is ready to go.
And here is the opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn.
We will build a fairer Britain where wealth and power are shared. The Conservative government is failing. It's failed on the economy, on the climate crisis, the National Health Service, and on Brexit.
So one of the things we hear there, Rob, is that Boris Johnson says we have a Brexit deal that's ready to go. And on Brexit, Jeremy Corbyn is not so clear about what he and the Labour Party would do if he were to gain power.
There are two things that are going to determine the outcome of this election. And one is it's sort of Brexit, and the other one is Mr. Corbyn. What I mean by that is that it's not so much the detailed discussion of Brexit. I mean, that is non-existent in this campaign. I mean, it's astonishing. So why is it about Brexit? It's in this sense, Jeremy. It's about what happens to the two blocks of votes, the Leave votes from 2016 and the Remain votes, and what it looks like is happening and why it seems Mr. Johnson is going to do well. Is that essentially most of the people that voted Leave in 2016, they're going behind Mr. Johnson, the Conservatives, whereas the Remain vote is rather fragmented. It's going to all of the various opposition parties, which means that they are in big trouble. And the other factor in this election, the unpopularity of Mr. Corbyn, and he is spectacularly unpopular. I mean, the polls suggest he is the most unpopular leader since this kind of polling began. And that leads me to this final point. Not that anyone should think that Mr. Johnson, you know, is fantastically popular and liked, but this is very much what's been referred to. Americans will understand this, Jeremy, an ugly baby contest, and it's regarded that Mr. Johnson marginally less ugly than Mr. Corbyn. My apologies to babies.
But the interesting thing here is that if all this actually goes as it looks like it will, and Johnson wins a big majority with his Conservatives, and the election is not really about Brexit, as you say, but Brexit would happen as a result of it, that there are going to still be half of the people in the UK who are very unhappy with that, even though that's not necessarily what they're voting on in this election.
That is an absolutely cracking point. And it's why, of course, there is a danger that Mr. Johnson's victory could be empty in the following sense. Number one, that this sort of coalition of voters that will have helped him to an election victory, if that indeed is what happened, that is people who voted Leave and who don't like Jeremy Corbyn, well, you know, that looks like a fairly fragile coalition. The other problem, as you say, for Mr. Johnson in winning this is that Brexit is just an immensely difficult and complex policy. And while it's true that he may win the election, it still will be the case that about half the country think that Brexit is a truly daft idea. Most businesses think it's a truly daft idea. Just about all of Britain's allies, I think apart from President Trump, thinks it's a truly crazy idea. Mm-hmm. So he will have won this sort of ugly baby contest and be stuck with this very, very difficult policy that he will need to implement.
That is BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Rob, thank you.
Thank you, and my apologies again to babies, and happy Thanksgiving.
You too. Well, here in the U.S., the number of deaths related to e-cigarettes is at 47. That's as of November 20th, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. There have also been more than 2,000 cases of lung injury associated with vaping products. Several states have already banned flavored e-cigarettes because those products have been shown to attract young people to vaping. But that doesn't help kids who are already addicted. Kavitha Cardosa from member station WAMU visited Fairfax County, Virginia, to look at how the school system there is trying to address that addiction.
Last year, a 15-year-old freshman in a Fairfax high school was offered a Juul, a flavored vaping product popular with young people. We're not using his name to protect his privacy. He was curious about the buzz he'd heard about, so he said, okay. Soon after, he got caught.
I got 1 day suspension and had to go to like a class about vaping. And a month of no sports or after school activities.
All of this came as a shock to his mother, Gail, who didn't know much about vaping. Gail grounded her son. Then a few months later, he was pulled out of class and searched. He had a Juul in his pocket.
And when I started to find first the little pieces of the device, the pods and the batteries, I didn't recognize what it was.
This time he was given a 2-day suspension and a year with no after-school activities. No Friday night football games, no trying out for the baseball team. He tried to stop.
And then I got nicotine withdrawals, like a headache and like sweating and like fidgeting. Then like I would call my mom and I'd be like, can you pick me up? I don't feel good. And I didn't really care about doing stuff at that point. I was just like, well, I'm already in trouble. I Juul, like I'm addicted. What's the point?
Gail had to accept her son had a serious problem.
It was nothing I could do. The school took a punishment-only approach. He was spiraling downward into depression and anger. He was isolated, and so he was using more. The punishment was just driving him into a mental health crisis and not stopping his addiction.
That's when Gail realized how little help there is for kids who are already addicted to e-cigarettes, and she's pushed the PTA and Fairfax school system to focus on the problem. Vaping among kids has skyrocketed, says Dr. Karen Wilson, who heads the American Academy of Pediatrics Tobacco Consortium. She says the latest research shows almost 27% of teenagers have used e-cigarettes in the past month. Adding to the problem, vaping can deliver more nicotine faster than cigarettes. And many kids don't realize just how addictive that nicotine can be.
All of the kids who are current users of electronic cigarettes probably need some kind of help to quit.
So when a child brings a vaping device to school even after having been caught, Wilson says it's likely they're not being defiant, but that they can't stop.
Teenagers are saying that they're so addicted they have to wake up in the middle of the night to use these products. They can't go more than 2 hours.
Wilson says the medical community has also been slow to respond. That's because there isn't a lot known about the long-term health effects of vaping on developing bodies and brains, or how to address this kind of addiction in young people. For example, the nicotine patch is one of the most common therapies for adults trying to quit cigarettes. But it isn't yet FDA approved for teens younger than 18, so many pediatricians won't prescribe them for kids. Jane Miscavige represents all PTAs in Fairfax County, more than 40,000 parents.
It is a huge, huge problem. It is all around us. It is insidious and invisible, and most parents are completely oblivious.
Miscavige says raising awareness of the dangers of vaping and treatment options will be their number one priority this year. Fairfax County Public Schools is now changing how they deal with vaping, moving from a punitive-only response to recognizing vaping as a health concern. Stefan Moskal oversees wellness initiatives and says 3 years ago they saw about 70 students. The next year?
That number jumped to more than 400 because of the explosion of vaping. Last year we provided more than 600.
In response, his office has shifted from scared straight style presentations by lawyers and police officers to information and addiction support. They plan to have 17 substance abuse specialists rotating between schools who'll connect parents to actual people who can help, including outpatient counseling sessions and a support group.
Fairfax has certainly moved in the direction of recognizing that there are students who are involved with something and they need support, and that we have a certain responsibility to provide as much support as we can. The move to supporting students, I think, is absolutely critical.
While Fairfax is trying to help students that were previously overlooked, it's unclear how the school system will cope with the growing demand. For Here and Now, I'm Kavita Cardoza in Washington.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world. And when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations. Thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
One thing all humans have in common is that at a certain point in our childhood, we all go through puberty. We get bigger, our bodies change, we often get a little rambunctious and moody, and we mature sexually. Well, imagine if that happened not when you were 11 or 13 or 15, but when you were a toddler. That's the experience of Patrick Burley, who has a rare genetic mutation that triggers testosterone production in boys as young as 2 years old. Doctors call it precocious puberty. Patrick Burley is now 40 years old, and he wrote about his experience in New York Magazine earlier this year. I spoke with Burley in January, and I asked him first just to explain his condition, precocious puberty, or testotoxicosis.
Yeah. So this particular kind of precocious puberty is called male familial limited precocious puberty, and it's extremely rare. It's estimated that there might be like fewer than 1,000 mm-hmm. of us. And basically, it's a mutation of the luteinizing hormone choriogonadotropin receptor gene, which is responsible for triggering testosterone production in the testicles.
And when did you or when did your parents first realize that you had it?
Well, my father had it, and my grandfather and my great-grandfather. So they were anticipating it, and they started to see symptoms of puberty when I was about 2 years old.
What do you mean symptoms at that age?
Pubic hair, essentially. Pubic hair, I was bigger, considerably bigger than a two-year-old, and also impulsive behavior that's characteristic of someone going through puberty.
Like
just, you know, an inability to control my impulses, you know, aggressive outbursts, hitting other kids, tantrums that were kind of truly epic, just behavior that was extreme.
And in terms of your size, I mean, there's a picture that you show in New York Magazine where you're with a sports team as a kid and you're like twice the size of all the other kids on the team.
Yeah, I was huge. I mean, I was the first time I went to I was treated for the mutation at the National Institutes of Health in Maryland. And my first visit, I was about 3 years old, and I weighed as much and was as tall as a seven-year-old and had the testosterone levels of a 14-year-old, mm-hmm. kind of deep in the throes of puberty. So I was huge, and I was not just bigger, but also, you know, I had all this testosterone coursing through my body. So I was muscular. And, you know, when I was 3 and 4 years old, I was kind of basically until I was about 7, sort of an athletic phenom. I was hitting home runs, and I was like, everyone wanted me on their team because I was just much bigger and stronger.
How aware were you of what was going on?
I knew I was different, obviously, and I knew that, you know, I was taking a lot of medication to suppress the production of testosterone. So I knew that, you know, there was something sort of wrong with me biologically. But beyond that, I didn't know much. And I also, you know, I have no memory of a time before all of this, you know. So there was no moment when it kind of changed for me physically, which is normally what happens when you're, you know, a conscious 13-year-old and your body starts to change.
And is that the way that you thought of it? Is that there was something wrong with you?
Yeah. Yes. Because it was so behavioral and because I was, you know, beginning at about 4 and 5, I started to get in trouble in school a lot because I just wasn't able to control my impulses, and I looked so dramatically different from everyone else that, you know, sort of normal misbehavior was amplified in my case. And, you know, if there were a group of us and we were all, you know, doing something wrong on the playground, like I stuck out and would kind of take the blame. And so sort of being bad and looking different and feeling different was all sort of packaged up together.
You also, as you write, started sort of experimenting sexually pretty young.
I did. It was, I started to lie about my age when I was probably about 8. It was easy to do this because I looked so much older, and it was also, in a way, it was easier for me to not have to explain why I looked so much older.
Just pretend that you actually were.
Exactly. Yeah. So I would just tell people that I was, you know, when I was 8, I would tell them I was 12 or 13. And so I started to hang out with older kids and kids who were, you know, doing things that were kind of beyond my peers. And, you know, and that meant sexual stuff. And it also meant smoking cigarettes and experimenting with substances and, you know, kind of all the rebellious behavior that's normally associated with teenagers, I started to do when I was considerably younger.
What did your father, who also had the same thing, what did he tell you all along the way? It sounds like he was rather reserved about it, didn't want to talk about it that much.
Yeah, yeah. It had been very difficult for him, not only because of everything that I'm describing now, but also there were just circumstances about his childhood that were especially challenging. And for that reason, he didn't want to investigate that with me, which was, you know, it was a defense mechanism. It was a way for him to survive and cope. And, you know, he grew up in the 50s and the 60s, and I think there's also a sort of a generational mindset that contributes to that. And so, you know, he was very loving and very supportive of me. But, you know, he never sat me down and said, you know, listen, I know what you're going through. I know you're, you know, having sexual feelings at 5. You know, I've been there, and this is kind of how you should navigate it, because this is how I navigated it. Those conversations didn't happen.
Once you turned, what, like 15, everyone else kind of caught up to you?
Yeah, about 14 or 15. Everyone else caught up, and I also finished, you know, and kind of the convergence of those two really, like, it was almost overnight. You know, all of a sudden I kind of looked around and I no longer stuck out. I was no longer, you know, this outcast. And also just hormonally, I was all of a sudden kind of more subdued.
And then that's it. There are no more effects after that. Once you've finished puberty, you're done?
Yeah, basically. I mean, there's the one kind of lingering is that men who have this, they don't grow to their full stature, what they call target height. So like most men who have had familial male-limited precocious puberty end up only being around 5 feet tall. Mm-hmm. I ended up being 6 feet tall, and I think that's a combination of the medication that I took and all my treatment, as well as just having tall genes. Like my brother is 6'6", and he didn't inherit mm-hmm. the mutation. So I think I was lucky in that way. But other than that, no, there no. It's purely developmental. Once, you know, puberty is done with you, it's done. It goes away.
Was it a relief when it was done? Or how did that feel when you grew up your whole childhood, you're different than everybody else, and then all of a sudden you're the same?
You know, I mean, I still kind of feel different, honestly, mm-hmm. even though, you know, if you met me, you wouldn't think of me as different. But I think those feelings of being other and not fitting in, as well as sort of being labeled bad, you know, from an early age, you know, they stayed with me, even though, you know, by the time I was 15 or 16, I had sort of made a 180 degree turn in my life, and I was no longer getting in trouble, and I did well in school, and I was, you know, a decent athlete. So I think that I did, once I began to fit in, I did feel relief, and at the same time, like a desire to, not unlike my father, kind of hide my past and hide the challenges and the what I felt for a long time was kind of a deviant past.
That is Patrick Burley, and that is just part of his story. Tomorrow, we'll hear the rest of our conversation as Patrick discusses the decision he and his wife made about whether or not to screen their embryos for this genetic mutation and to select embryos without it so their son wouldn't go through the same struggles that Patrick, his father, grandfather, and great-grandfather had gone through. By the way, his great-grandfather has an amazing story of his own. He was so big as a 13-year-old that he was able to enlist in the Navy and fight in World War I.
He suffered mustard gas poisoning and was hospitalized. And only then did the U.S. government discover that he was actually only 13 at the time. And they sent him home.
That part of the story tomorrow on Here and Now. And you can read more about Patrick at hereandnow.org. China is warning it could take firm countermeasures if the United States continues to show support for pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong. That warning follows a signing yesterday by President Trump of bills that reaffirm the U.S.-Hong Kong Policy Act of 1992, which requires the Secretary of State to certify that Hong Kong is independent enough from Beijing to keep its favored trading status with the U.S. The bills also sanction Hong Kong and Chinese officials found guilty of human rights abuses and banned the export of certain non-lethal munitions to Hong Kong police. Joining us now is the BBC's Jeff Lee. He's in Hong Kong. Jeff, tell us more about how people there are reacting to this apparent show of support from President Trump.
Jimmy, they have been very happy with President Trump signing the bill because they think the acts will act as a protector against some Hong Kong officials who have been allegedly abusing their power towards the protesters. They think the act would allow the U.S. government to impose sanctions against those officials deemed responsible, and it will make them think twice before abusing their power again.
And China, as we said, is not happy about this. What is Beijing saying that it may do? What might these firm countermeasures be?
The Foreign Affairs released a statement today saying the U.S. has been disregarding facts and distorting the truth. It has also accused the U.S. of openly backing violent criminals As you've mentioned, the ministry has threatened countermeasures, but the ministry's statement has not given any specifics. So as we all know, the U.S. and China, they're involved in a trade war, mm-hmm. and officials from both countries, they're still trying to negotiate a final agreement. So any countermeasures we may be able to see from the final agreement?
Well, and some of the reporting about this says that China may be too scared to derail the progress on a possible trade deal to actually do anything significant as a countermeasure to this action by the president of the United States. Is there reaction today from Carrie Lam, Hong Kong's leader, to what's just happened?
She hasn't openly commented on the act, but the Hong Kong government did release a statement saying that the act passed was unreasonable because the title of the act contained the word democracy, but the Hong Kong government said the acts are actually about export control and enforcement of sanctions imposed by the UN in Hong Kong, which the government says is totally unrelated to human rights in democracy. The statement has also mentioned the U.S. interests, business interests in Hong Kong, and said the act may affect this kind of ties between Hong Kong and the U.S.
Jeff, do you think that this action by the U.S. gives the protest movement in Hong Kong any new momentum?
Definitely. And this act, along with the district council election this last Sunday, which the pro-democracy camp got a lot of seats from the pro-Beijing camp, the protest movement will realize how much actual support they have, and they can plan their next steps accordingly.
That is the BBC's Jeff Lee speaking with us from Hong Kong. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you.
If you find yourself hanging around the house this holiday weekend, it might be a good time to catch up on your garden. Yes, you can garden in the fall and winter. Here with some tips is Deborah Kanapke. She's a garden consultant in Columbus, Ohio. Her business is called The Garden Sage. She's also a writer and teacher. Deborah, thanks for joining us and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Same to you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so it is still fall, even though in many places it feels like winter.
It does.
But is there anything that people can do if they want to go outside and work in the garden right now and maybe at least set things up for a good spring next year?
There's a ton. I don't even know where to start. But one of the things that people might think of doing is finally getting those bulbs in that they bought back in September and are sitting in the garage. You have about another week, at least, you know, in here I'm in Columbus, Ohio. So I have to admit, I have planted bulbs all the way up to Christmas. Although that year I got mostly leaves, I didn't get as many flowers, but planting bulbs, going out and weeding, edging beds, you know, it all depends on what your plans are for the next year. And that might be the first thing you might think about doing is looking at what didn't work last year and trying to figure out how you can make it work next year or just throw it out and start over.
Well, and tell me, why would you plant bulbs now for next year?
Well, normally I like to plant in October, but I found a sale and I was able to pick up a bunch of bulbs for less than half price. And I thought, okay, I'll put them in. And so I planted bulbs last week.
And they'll last through the winter?
They do. Well, the bulbs I'm talking about are the ones that bloom in spring, your daffodils, tulips, the little tiny, wonderful minor bulbs, the little squills and glory in the snow, etc. Those all are planted in fall. We also have some really beautiful summer blooming bulbs, but you would plant those in the spring once a chance of frost has passed.
And you said weeding would be a good idea right about now.
Well, we have had it. We got this incredible cold, and then it got a little warm, and now it's cold again. But in the meantime, we have these weeds called annual weeds that take advantage of that brief warm spell. And the next thing you know, you have weeds all over the place. One of the weeds in particular that I talk about and that people know about is the winter bittercress. It looks like this cute little rosette. It's so cute. And then it blooms and it has cute little white flowers. And then it makes about 1 million seeds. And the next thing you know, you're battling this weed every year and you have this carpet of winter bittercress. And you're thinking, how in the world did that happen? And it all starts from about, 10 plants.
When you look at your garden at this time of year, in many places, it's probably covered with leaves from trees. Is it worth getting rid of all of those, getting them out of the way?
It depends. And I just want the listeners to think, does anybody rake the leaves in the woods? No. So it's a good idea to leave those leaves back there. They insulate the plants and the plants come up better in the spring for it. Now, an exception to that is if you have some plants that would be, harmed because there are too many leaves on top of them, you could take the leaves and kind of spread them out, still leaving some leaves on top, but not as much. And what I do, our township goes and picks up all the leaves in our neighborhood. And I ask for a load or two to be dropped in my yard. And I edge all my beds with those chopped up mulch leaves.
What does that mean, you edge all your beds?
Well, first what I do is I will take a shovel and I'll cut the grass so the grass isn't going into the bed, and just kind of throw that grass into my good compost pile. And then I have this kind of clean edge, and I will take the mulch leaves and about a foot back into the bed, I'll just pile them up about 4 to 6 inches. And that adds nutrients in the soil. Mm. The organisms that are in the soil will break down those leaves further and take it back down in and feed your trees, shrubs, herbaceous plants, you name it.
Are you noticing differences because of climate change in the world of gardening right now?
Oh, yeah. I've been a gardener for over 30 years. Mm-hmm. And we've always had freeze-thaw cycles, but now I'm seeing the freeze-thaw cycles then turn into deep cold or high heat. Mm-hmm. And our plants aren't used to that. You know, the joke is, oh, gosh, here autumn was from November 1st to November 9th, here in Columbus. That was a joke on Facebook. But it's almost true. So our seasons seem like they're truncated or that they're chopped up or that we have spring or summer in the middle of October.
So is there anything that you can do about that as a gardener to adapt to the situation?
It's all about finding plants that are resilient and adaptable. And that can become difficult because we don't know yet how all of our plants are going to react to these changes in climate.
Okay, so let's jump forward, if you will, to the spring. What month do you like to plant things, other than these bulbs that you'll leave underground there all winter long? What other when do you start planting?
Again, I'm going to say it depends. You can start planting trees and shrubs as early as late March, mid-March into mid-April is my favorite time for trees and shrubs, although I'll plant trees and shrubs all season long. I love to plant perennials in April, mid-April to late April, into May, into June. Then you're dealing with the heat, and you might want to back off and wait until planting perennials again in the fall, late August into September and October. I usually stop planting perennials around October 15th. And what I try to do is take my cue from Mother Nature.
So I've got some geraniums outside my house, and I also brought one inside, and it's been growing in the kitchen, looking outside at the other ones. And the ones outside, that's it. They're done. It's too cold. But do you think that the one inside will last all winter long?
Yes. What you have, the beautiful geraniums, are actually from South Africa. They are a zone 9-10 plant, like Florida. Think Florida. Mm-hmm. And they are tree-like organisms in South Africa. I have seen the annual geraniums in a pot. My grandmother had one, and it lived for years and years and years, and she just hacked it back. So, yes, it will live as long as you take care of it.
Do you suggest that people bring any other plants inside for the winter and just try to hold on to them and then put them back outside in the spring?
I'm going to say this again. This is 3 for 3. It depends. You know, like the impatiens that you put out, I usually let Mother Nature take those. But if I plant a rosemary, I'll bring our rosemaries in. Otherwise, they're toast. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a whole conversation in itself, indoor plants, which are now the craze. It's wonderful. I love seeing that indoor plants are coming back because I think they brighten the mood in the winter when we've just about had enough of cold.
Absolutely. So, final question. Mm-hmm. If someone's listening to this, and I'm sure there are many who are listening to this who don't garden at all, but maybe they're curious about it, what is a good thing for a beginner to do?
Go and purchase some succulents, which are these beautiful architectural plants. There are the cacti, which are sharp, and there are the succulents, the other kinds of succulents that don't have thorns, and put them in a bright sunny window and enjoy them this winter. And then this spring or summer, maybe grow one tomato or one chili or one pepper, or grow one beautiful rose in a pot or in the ground by your front door where you can smell its perfume. Start small and then start adding. And give me a call if you have any questions.
Well, I will say that growing a pepper as a beginner gardener that I am is much easier than growing a tomato.
That's an interesting comment. I'd like to explore that with you sometime.
Just don't hold up. That is Deborah Kanapke, who's a garden consultant in Columbus, Ohio. Her business is called The Garden Sage. Deborah, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for asking.
More than half of Americans over the age of 65 have a chronic condition, diabetes, cancer, or Alzheimer's disease, and many have more than one. So when they go into the emergency room, it can be complicated for doctors. As a result, some emergency departments are making targeted investments to better serve older patients. Kathy Ritchie from member station KJZZ in Phoenix reports.
We're coming to a facility with a 65-year-old male. He's in a memory care area of a retirement home.
Calls like this aren't unusual at Banner University Medical Center in Phoenix. Staff here see more than 1,000 patients a month who are 65 and older. Nationally, emergency departments, or EDs, are treating seniors at higher rates than non-seniors, according to the American College of Emergency Physicians. So last year, this medical center stepped up and became one of only 100 or so accredited geriatric EDs in the country, and the only one in Arizona.
We know that older adults, when they come into the ED, they have more complications.
Dr. Nimit Agarwal is the chief of geriatrics at Banner University Medical Center.
And there was a need for improving the care of these patients when they come to the emergency department.
Falls are the leading cause of injury-related deaths among older adults, according to the CDC. And preventing falls is one of the center's biggest initiatives. Agarwal says it means using an interdisciplinary approach.
We have nurses who are specially trained for detection of falls. We have a pharmacist who looks at their medications. We have the physicians who get training every month on what geriatrics-focused care could be.
This probably sounds like what should be happening in every ED, but geriatric EDs are in short supply. Dr. Kevin Bice chairs the Geriatric Emergency Department Accreditation Program at the American College of Emergency Physicians. He says every ED in the country should aim for a bronze-level certification, which is the most basic of the three accreditation levels.
To have a bronze level of certification, you need to have a champion physician, a champion nurse, and do at least one quality improvement project to make your ED better for older adults.
Like Banner's Fall Initiative, silver and gold require much higher commitment levels, so having things like pressure ulcer reducing mattresses, reclinable armchairs, or creating a protocol for identifying elder abuse or a dementia screening protocol and follow-up. Still, with more than 4,500 EDs in the entire country, there are only 107 accredited geriatric EDs, says Bice. Something else this country lacks are geriatricians, especially in a state like Arizona. The American Geriatric Society says a state should have more than 500 geriatricians, but as of 2018, there were only 117. Julie Kobos is a nursing director for Banner's Emergency Department. She takes me on a tour of the geriatric ED. There's not a separate ward for older patients, though that's the goal. Rather, there are six age-friendly rooms.
That is my only age-friendly patient right now. It's a 68-year-old patient, and so the sign is on the door. It's been explained to the patient as to if there's any needs that need to be met, we're here to attend to them.
Like providing extra pillows and blankets, non-slip socks, making sure their belongings are nearby so patients don't climb out of bed. And if a patient forgets their hearing aids?
We have hearing devices. We have magnifiers in there if they're having problems seeing, they forgot their glasses or what have you. Earplugs in case it gets too loud or noisy, because it can get really crazy in here.
It can also be really scary, especially for a patient with dementia. Staff here are trained to care for that population, which in Arizona is expected to increase from 140,000 to 200,000 by 2025, according to the Alzheimer's Association. Again, Dr. Agarwal.
Having a staff which knows the TADAs, which is TADA, it's a mnemonic that stands for tolerate, anticipate, do not agitate. So we train our nurses to follow that technique to calm the person down so that we don't have to use medicine or any physical restraint.
The hospital also tries to hire nurses who have experience working at assisted living facilities. Earlier, Julie Kobos told me a story about one of her nurses and a 78-year-old patient with Alzheimer's disease.
Bless her heart, she was very scared, she was very confused, doing a lot of yelling in the room. The nurses kept trying to comfort her, so my charge nurse did a really cool thing.
That nurse was Brandy Cano.
This little lady kept wandering everywhere, and she was pretty quick on her feet. We thought she was going to escape, so I had her sit by me, she ate lunch, and
she settled down. That small gesture changed everything, and sometimes that's all it takes, human connection. Dr. Bice of the Geriatric Accreditation Program says that in 2018, people 65 and older made about 20 million ED visits, and that figure will likely continue to increase as baby boomers age. Further indication that healthcare has no choice but to change the way it does business. For Here and Now, I'm Kathy Ritchie.
And we are here for you following the news on this Thanksgiving Day. We are thankful for our Thanksgiving staff, Frankie Paris, Chris Ballman, Todd Munt, Tinku Ray, Karen Miller-Medson, Alex Ashlock, James Trout, Mike Moschetto, Allison Hagen, and Serena McMahon. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Happy Thanksgiving.